Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Beyond Bitcoin, a program about everything that isn't Bitcoin in this decentralized world that we exist in, covered with non-fungible tokens and DeFi products and layer one and layer two. Let's go through that as we chat always. We're always interested in your feedback. I welcome along, of course, my partner today, my friend and colleague, Nitin Gower, to join us. Hello, Nitin.
Hey, Derek. Glad to be here on our episode 5. My name is Nitin, and I serve as Director of Financial Sciences and Digital Assets, and also part of research, you know, head of research for Portal Asset Management. So glad to be here, Derek.
Terrific. That's great. And of course, I'm the CEO of Portal Asset Management, which is what we describe as our day job. Our passion is this space. And our interest is in this space. Now, typical of exactly that genre, I'd like to welcome along today Jules Chen, who is our Chief Research Officer in Portal Asset Management, lives and breathes this space, and can bring to us something that you and I can't, and that's just the culture of who Jules is. And so welcome along, Jules.
Thanks, Derek. Really excited to be on. Hi, Nitin.
Hey, Jules. Glad to have you on the show. Looking forward to this conversation, as always.
So like normal, we always chat a little bit about what's happened during the week before we meander through our discussion today, which is going to, I think, mostly going to be about non-fungible tokens, is my guess. But let's just have a little bit of a discussion about what happened. Just last week, you and I were discussing Solana and the fact that it was highly centralized and that comes with it some problems. They went off the air for 15 hours during the week, just in case you thought that was centralized. And they actually took themselves off the air to resolve some programming glitches. What happened, Nitin?
No, this is certainly an interesting event because we have been talking about the exponential rise of Solana and looking into the rise in NFT space leading to transaction volumes and Solana touting itself in terms of 50,000 TPS volumes. So a few things to go back. In blockchain space, we talk about trifecta. Trifecta is basically, you know, balancing out the performance, scalability, and what we use the moniker in computer science space is something called CAP or CAP theorem. You know, CAP stands for consistency, availability, and partition awareness. Not to go into details, but the whole point is you have to sacrifice something. And in a truly decentralized systems, which are truly global systems, which is what Ethereum and Bitcoins are, these are systems that are coordinating the transaction processing across the globe, which takes time for electrons to go back and forth between different parts of the world for them to come to an agreement or consensus before they agree on a transaction. And many of the newer age blockchain platforms have agreed upon sort of essentially saying that can we create decentralization through governance and not sacrifice the notion of the distributed nature of the computing to alleviate the round trip nature of this communication protocol that happens to achieve that consensus. And so there's a whole debate that ensues between what we call as, you know, true decentralization, going after performance hits that you get, and going after either quasi decentralization or quasi centralization. And so Solana had taken the path in effort to achieve very high throughputs, is suggesting that we can achieve level of decentralization through their consensus mechanism and using staking protocols as a vehicle to induce sort of decentralization while co-locating this machine in the servers to be able to provide that transaction platform and transaction systems to then support the various DeFi and various NFT projects that are evolving on these things. So when you begin to centralize these things, or when you begin to host them in certain locations, some of these locations present a risk that if a network were to go down or someone trips over a wire, for example, that kicks off, let's say, 1/3 of the capacity of the entire network because they're centralized, then the entire network has to reconcile to say, hey, we have lost 1/3 of capacity. So how do I readjust myself to make do with the remaining 2/3 of the systems? And that's what happened. If you look at the validator nodes, which is essentially the system that provides security to it, there are about 550 validators in Solana, and I think they were confined to a subnet, and they had to take 12 hours to sort of fix those things, and they happen to be in cloud infrastructure, which I think is an anti-pattern to truly decentralized networks. Mm-hmm. But it was not a security problem. It was not a quote unquote hack. It was a glitch. And that's why the markets didn't react in a negative way to the valuation of Solana. And I think in many cases, in my personal experience with Stellar back in the day, if you recall, during consensus, Stellar was down for, I think, 30 plus hours. And I was building a payment network on Stellar. All these events do is make the network stronger. It helps them understand vulnerabilities. It helps them fix these things. So on the long run, this is all a good thing, as long as it is not a security vulnerability, which is, you know, which would have been a different problem, I think. So I'll stop at that and see if that made sense.
Very good, it does. Look, what to put some context to this, this is talking about layer one protocols. Well, another word for that or a term is distributed ledger technology. Another term for that is blockchain technology. We're talking about blockchains here. And remember, there's not just one blockchain that will operate the world of decentralized finance and the world of non-fungible tokens. There's a number of them. And earlier on, we were chatting with Jules, and she actually called each one of these blockchains lands of opportunities. And I thought it was a really good term, Jules, because what you're talking about here is you're talking about real estate upon which things can be built. And just this morning on CoinDesk, it was noted that Avalanche has just received $230 million worth of investment from the likes of Pantera, I recall, and another large VC company. And most of that $230 million going to Avalanche is going into create liquidity pools, make it run smoother, create an environment where people can trade into it. But of course, there's Polkadot, there's Cardano, we mentioned Solana, and then there's Ethereum, and then there are a lot of others to follow. These are all these lands of opportunities. Some of those lands are better suited, maybe, to the world of non-fungible tokens. It was only yesterday that we had a great lecture and webinar from Irina Karagaru. And Irina is with Polkadot, and she spoke on Portal's monthly webcast. And by the way, Portal's monthly webcast is now available on podcast each month if you want to go and listen to that and previous webcasts as we get these independent and interesting speakers that come in. And she was really talking about community and about how important that is. And you know, time is an important thing here because it reminds me of a story that I remember getting told, analogy, and that was that the story was this particular ant was a very, very well-known ant in the ant community. And he'd built a lot of the ant colony and he'd fought battles against the other ants. And he'd really done an exceptional job. And these two ants were talking to each other saying how extraordinary that this ant was. And this ant was likely to be remembered for weeks. We've got to put into context how long we live and how the future is going to be. My view of this is that we are in these good old days. We're in the days when Steve Jobs was welding up his Apple boards and attending computer geek gatherings. You know, we're at the days when Bill Gates was at school and working late at night trying to resolve hacking problems and getting paid for it. We're at these really early days. And although we think we live forever, the likelihood of this enormous, you know, distributed ledger, multi-distributed ledger technology that's running the entire commerce of community being with us for the next five or six generations is high. I say that because although I'm excited about this space and part of my life will no doubt trade on this space, Jules, you're a Gen Y and you're a digital native. And I really want to hear your generation's view of the beginning of this space that I think will go for years. And we'll make our little lives relevant to that 3 weeks of those ants.
You know, I really like that story, Derek. How I view this space, it really sums up with the land of opportunity because it presents freedom and opportunity. I often think about my mom moving from China to Australia, and she moved because of more freedom and more opportunity. And I think this is why young people love crypto. They're embracing the technology. You know, blockchain really is the land of opportunity for us. And there's this analogy of a nightclub, and inside the nightclub is success. And normally for young people, we're right at the end of the line, and people at the front are the older generation. They've got more experience, they've got more contacts, and look, they're going to do better than us. We have to spend 10 years to be an expert in this space. And now we have this beautiful moment where we can go to the front of the line. And yes, just by studying this industry. So instead of 10 years of studying something to be an expert, you can dedicate a couple of years and, you know, be pretty well-versed than a lot of other people. And yeah, so I think this is, you know, and technology is like the only thing that your parents ask you for advice, you know, right? Like they know everything else better than you, or at least think so. But when it comes to technology, they always come to you. So, you know, Bitcoin, I know this show is called Beyond Bitcoin, but Bitcoin is really important because it means freedom. You know, it's humans' first experiment at separating money from state. And that's really beautiful. And I think if you're not perhaps more libertarian at heart, it's hard to appreciate how beautiful the solution is. And, you know, I often envision it as this tree, and from all the other crypto projects grows from. And without Bitcoin, there will be no other, there wouldn't be Ethereum. And so that really paves the way for all these other projects to flourish. And you mentioned NFTs, and that's one of the things that have resulted from Bitcoin paved. And the incredible thing about NFTs, it's giving people rights to their work. So if you think about, if we didn't have property rights, how would our world look like, right? We would be living maybe a more socialist lifestyle.
Can I just jump in there for one moment? Yeah. And that is, just describe for us NFTs. What is an NFT? How is it might be used? Just to set some context around that, and then, you know, let's go on the journey between NFTs and social NFTs and real estate NFTs, et cetera. Over to you, Jules.
And Jules, before you answer that, I'd like to know if Derek, do you go to nightclubs yet? And are you in front of the line?
That's really tough, but I can't say I am in front of the line of nightclubs anymore, and no one asked for my ID, which is very disappointing. But the analogy is perfect. There's nothing more annoying being at the end of the queue, you know.
That's true. Over to you, Jules.
We found a backdoor entrance to the nightclub, so that's why we're partying.
VIP backstage.
So non-fungible tokens is a unique token. So it's different from Bitcoin and the dollar because they can be easily swapped. NFT is a unique resemblance of something that can't be exchanged for something else. So artwork, property, music, you can tokenize it so that it's and unique. What that gives, it's also showing ownership. And so for an artist, when you tokenize an NFT, you can own the media. And so this allows artists to create different new business models. It's also easier to transfer between the consumer, and also it can be verified on the blockchain. So the authenticity, the provenance of that is easily identified, securely transferred. And then it also lets the creator, say, put royalties in from secondary sales.
Yes.
So primarily artists would only make money from the first sale, and then secondary sale, they have no control over that. Well, now they can say that I want 10% of every second sale. And that is really powerful, and it's giving a new revenue stream to creators?
Let me ask another question that, Jules. And this is, again, you are defined as Gen Z, and I'm looking going back to Gen X and Gen Y, which is in the Facebook era, where network effect, similar sort of theme to what we see in blockchain world, ensued, right? We looked into network effect, we looked into giving freedom to content creators, and Facebook and many social media platforms did amazing things for the world. We had Arab Springs, we had this waves of movement of freedom around the world. Mm. And we also have seen the downside of that ecosystem, right? Privacy and, you know, invasion of our privacies and misusing our data, which we've seen with Cambridge Analytica of the world, and you know, eavesdropping on and taking advantage of this and, you know, victimizing that whole openness of these platforms. As a Gen Zer, as you're defining this moment, as you forge ahead with providing that independence and freedom that you talk about, do you see a similar downside where the content creators were sort of the champions of the social media network, and suddenly now the creators of art and music are seen champions in the NFT movement? Do you see any downside of this as a Gen Zer, or do you think that the lessons we've learned from the past social networks will not repeat itself? And perhaps secure these in more ways than one, and preserve that, you know, anonymity and privacy, and or at least give us the option to do that from identity and things like that, if that makes sense.
I haven't really thought about the security aspect. The downside I do see is a different angle, and that's more around sales, because, you know, salespeople play an important role. You know, we don't probably give enough credit to salespeople. And when you're an artist, you can be amazing at creating music, art, YouTube videos, whatever your creation is, but you might not be a good salesperson. And so does that make it less inequitable, because the ones who are really good at selling themselves, well, they're going to make all the revenue? Say someone who's created a avatar NFT, and the ones who are popular are going to make so much money, and the ones who don't have that influence, the marketing skills, that could present some inequality. But I'd love to hear your aspects around security, because it's something that I actually haven't given as much thought.
I think you touched upon this earlier, Jules, and maybe even the call that we had prior to this this conversation around using identity and using this soft identity as one way to protect both the rights, as well as, you know, giving you an ability to be who you are, which is another challenge in the space. So using identity as non-fungible tokens, and then using that identity as a avenue to interact with this digital interactive platforms, what we have been defining as metaverse. So I could have a digital identity. I could then participate in this ecosystem via NFTs, whether the NFTs represent a asset class or NFTs represent a digital rights management platform, giving you the rights to do a few things, namely in gaming platform. And so you can see how there are these dots that I can connect with a virtual avatar, which used to be a Web 2.0 terminology, now into a metaverse persona that we are trying to bring to life, and using that and creating. And I don't know, I mean, this is, to me, NFT, as we have discussed prior, is a convergence and amalgamation of social, cultural, gaming ecosystems and cultures coming together. So it's a new phenomenon altogether. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think, going just back to the security point, wouldn't it be better that a decentralized organization is handling if we're using unique universal profiles? We don't want a centralized company controlling that, because, you know, cancel culture, censorship, that would probably be less favorable. So I think using NFTs is beneficial, but I don't know. I think there might be other risks and downside that I haven't really thought of.
See, it's interesting here, because so culturally, if you talk to a sort of a 65-year-old or a 70-year-old and talk about the internet, certainly if you did this 10 years ago, It would be this chatter about, oh, I wouldn't put my credit card on it. I don't trust it. So that generation's view on security, I think, is actually quite different to Gen Z, XY's view on security, because they've grown up their entire native digital life, plugging in a username and password, bang, they're on. Their level of concern about security is different. Now, naturally, when you're talking about security in regards to access wallets and things like that, obviously that's important. But when you're talking about security in regards to see who I am, go and look at me on Facebook or look at me on something else. I don't care. So I think there's a generational difference in how people view security on the internet too.
Yeah, I think also it's interesting. We normally we think we prioritize security and personal information, but how often do you go into a store and they said, oh, you know, give us your name and address and we'll give you 10% yes. off? And yes. people, you know, quite, you know, they don't really think twice. But then when it comes to, and those sources can be hacked too, right? Like someone yes. at the store can use it for nefarious purposes. But when it comes to online, I think it just, yeah, it makes people more uncomfortable. But when you think about it, we give our information away, you know, in other areas.
You do. Yeah. And quite quickly, hey, this idea of zero knowledge ID based upon a DAO, wow, that's an incredible idea when you think about that. I mean, that could change the entire world's movement in regards to how people can move around the world and how governments can't destroy yeah. their passports. And maybe speak about that. And firstly, you know, that the fact that the zero knowledge ID is going to be Web 3.0 and how the DAO is going to be, you know, a layer one or layer two, maybe give us a bit of explanation around that, Nitin, because I think that's a fascinating yeah. area.
No, that's true. So let me start with Web 3.0 before we go into zero knowledge proof. So Web 3.0, so we had Web 1.0 where we consumed information through websites, and that's pretty much all we did. Web 2.0 came about allowing us to be able to buy airline tickets and book hotels and do banking and social media, which allows the interactive patterns with Web 2.0. Mm. And I think Web 3.0 is taking this to the whole new level and truly enabling this global platforms and, you know, bringing the singularity of true a single platform, whether it's for finance, whether it's for NFTs, which means you have same rules around the world, no matter where you're accessing, as long as you're playing by the rules, which means that what we see today in financial markets and capital markets and how we buy and sell assets differ from country to country, leading to arbitrages and leading to opacity of information, leading to centralization, that leading to vulnerabilities that Web 2.0 has surfaced. So Web 3.0 in general is the underlying infrastructure that facilitates the coordination of compute resources in a way that no single party has complete control of any single system. And the whole idea is that if we truly decentralize not just the compute resources, but the application that are built on top, namely the decentralized applications or dApps on blockchain, DLT networks, it gives a collective responsibility to the entire network to maintain privacy, only because the network is incentivized to preserve the network, because now there's an economic incentive in the system that they have to protect the privacy and security of the network, which helps them be rewarded with the crypto assets and cryptocurrency in the system. So that's the Web 3.0 mantra. Mm. Now, what ends up happening in Web 3.0 too, at the end of the day, it's data, and data that is moving on the wires can be copied and pasted and misused, if not for the direct purposes of impersonation, but also mining information about Derek and Jules and what they do, and giving out the information for coffee is very common, as you know, while we all clamor for our privacy in the system. But nonetheless, this is the same information going through the Web 3.0 wires. So we introduced, the industry have been talking about things like utilizing encryption. So we have technologies like fully homomorphic encryption, which basically says I'm going to encrypt the hell out of everything. And if I just need to know Derek is of legal age to buy booze, or to go into a nightclub, I need is yes or no. I don't need to know Derek's full name. I don't need to know Derek's address, where he lives, what he drives. I just need to know if he's able to do, which is what we call the implied consent, consent-based sort of systems. And we then looked into fully homomorphic encryption and something called zero knowledge proofs or ZKPs. And zero-knowledge proof essentially says that Derek and Nitin can transact without knowing any details about each other or about the transactions. But the system, the protocol itself, will do verification validation of the transaction, which allows me to trust the protocol, but not Derek. So it's, you know, trust but verify type of model where the protocol itself gives me, and the only downside of any of the encryption technologies that includes the fully or partially homomorphic encryption and zero knowledge proofs is the computational cost. Every time you encrypt and decrypt, there's a whole lot of CPU and machine power that goes into doing that function. And until now, it has been economically infeasible to invest that kind of compute resources. Until now, where we have seen specialized emergence of ASIC or new, you know, specialized compute chips, primarily for Bitcoin mining and Ether mining, they have been proven fairly robust in terms of bringing down the cost of doing these zero knowledge proofs, which the protocol itself will provide certain level of guarantees that me and Derek can do transactions and I can trust Derek to have X amount of money before he transfers it to me without knowing how much Derek has, as long as I can verify a wallet and so on and so forth. And that's essentially what zero knowledge is. Now, we're applying the same conceptual framework of zero knowledge proofs to things like zero knowledge identities, zero knowledge asset transfers, and so on and so forth, which basically says I don't need to have any knowledge of Derek as long as I can ascertain Derek is a real person. So I can do a few things like KYC and so on and so forth. Derek is above a certain age, so I can render what society deems to be certain products and services that are meant for adulthood and so on and so forth. And so some of these control procedures helps in compliance and regulation. And that's where these technologies come super handy, and we can envision building a truly global framework where I don't need to know if somebody's in Thailand or in Japan, as long as the system itself provides some level of verification validation, easing the burden of compliance, which today is a massive, massive global problem. So I'll pause at that to see Derek and Jules if that made sense, because there's a lot of jargon in there and I just want to make sure the audiences are able to understand this.
That's really interesting stuff to learn. And so would we see a DAO forming around a protocol like this to deliver something like this?
Yeah, so DAO or DAO, which is Decentralized Autonomous Organizations, is the term that was coined by Vitalik, the founder of Ethereum, envisioning that a code can be a company. You could form a typical corporation, and state of Wyoming, by the way, was the first state to give DAO a legal status. You could have a DAO incorporated into state of Wyoming in the United States. But DAO essentially was saying that, look, if you look at corporate, I work for a big corporation and we have all kinds of rules of hiring, of how we transact, who we do business with, but can I codify all that into a truly digital way? And this is metaverse, right? At the end of the day, I have a digital DAO interacting with another DAO, exactly like how, let's say, a company like IBM interacts with JPMC as a customer of each other, for instance. Can I have two DAOs talk to each other and adhere to certain rules of engagement that's codified into a DAO and that's deployed, and the network itself has the visibility of that interaction and does the verification validation of those transactions? And that's in true sense, two legal separate entities digitally interacting with each other without any human intervention at all. And that's essentially what you're referring to here, Jules, I think, is that, and these DAOs could be protected by the layer of zero knowledge proofs, or the transactions between them could have a layer of zero knowledge proof. So it's application of technology to either protect the transaction or protect the endpoint identity of these players, while ensuring that there's certain level of compliance in the system.
It is the concept of zero knowledge protocols operating on DAOs on a global basis is incredibly compelling, and the reason why is that if you've got a DAO that is validating your existence, but not who you are, and you could travel anywhere in the world based upon the validation of your existence, but not who you are, you've passed KYC, you've passed AML, you are valid, and therefore you're able to transfer and move around the world. You can't be written off a voting registration. You can't have your passport destroyed because the government has decided you're not allowed to travel. It gives you a level of freedom that would be extraordinary. And I'm not talking about freedom to be a drug lord, because you've got KYC and AML, you've been validated. What I'm talking about is freedom from a centralized government organization that could write you off in one go. And when you look at the sort of the circus, the theatrical circus that we've watched with this big lie that happened in America regarding voting rules and regulations, if that was all operated on zero knowledge, on a zero knowledge protocol and on a DAO, and you're able to put your vote in and it was validating that it was you, that could happen instantaneously. No ballot box, no pencils or papers, no queues, no fighting over whether they're looking for a place to put. Just go online, validate who you are, vote, move on. When you look at it, the system we operate now is centralized, archaic, and if you're in a developing nation, fraught with danger. So here we are. We're not talking about Bitcoin. We're talking about what blockchain can do, what a DAO might do, what a zero knowledge protocol could do for us as people, as international citizens. And that's typical of this space. That's why it's so extraordinarily exciting, because this space is opening up opportunities that are impossible to do using normal centralized systems or don't have a business model for that. But I want to get back to what Jules has been looking at in the world of non-fungible tokens, and also where women are up to in this space, and in fact, right across this blockchain space. They tend to be underrepresented, and you know, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, there's definitely not that many women interested in crypto, and I think as a whole, investing hasn't attracted as much women's interest compared to men. And so, but there is growing interest in crypto. I was looking at some of the stats, and 16% of men invest in crypto compared to 7% of women. If you compare that with, say, real estate, you know, 36% of men invest in real estate compared to 30% women. So that's a lot closer. But things like individual stocks, it's 40% men and 24% women. And, you know, and I think it just comes down to women have different interests, and typically the investment assets are probably not as appealing to a lot of women. But I think that is going to change, especially with NFTs, because this becomes a new asset class. Yes, it can be used as like social signaling or art, but it is a new asset that you can invest in and monetize your taste. So, you know, maybe we'll have kids investing in music and digital art and digital fashion instead of a portfolio of stocks. You know, NFTs give people a way to invest in something that they know about and they care about. So if you're interested in sports, you can buy an NFT of a sports player maybe before he gets really famous, or a musician, he can use his song as an NFT. When he issues the song as an NFT and you invest in it, well, maybe you can earn royalties on it or sell it for a lot more when they become famous. So there is this democratization of investing by opening up the areas of interest that you can invest in.
And
I think it's super exciting, and I think there's going to be a lot of areas that are going to attract women to the space.
So maybe we, in that particular area, you know, women tend to be extraordinarily creative and intuitive, right? We just obviously that, you know, you're not meant to gender bias, but my observation is very intuitive, very creative, and often very visual. And so fashion in this space and NFTs relating to fashion in this space, it must be something that's going to happen and start engaging people both in their own setting their own status in this world and letting that status be seen by others. And of course, that means fashion houses. Do you think there's going to be involvement in fashion houses and fashion in the non-fungible token space?
Yeah, definitely. I think we're all spending more time online, whether we realize it or not. We're we care about our digital identities. And as we spend more time in the metaverse or just online, I think the brands know where to market themselves, because they'll market themselves on where people are paying attention to. You know, we've seen how brands always have an online strategy now. And NFTs is a marketer's dream, whether you're an individual influencer or a big fashion house like LVMH or Dolce & Gabbana. These are companies that are thinking about their blockchain strategy. And NFTs is this new way to engage their customers, incentivize them to do things. It also is really good at generating hype, because when you deliver something and it's sought after, the price becomes a signal for other people to pay attention. And also the price, because there's value to the NFT, it also incentivizes them to deliver on that value. Like if they just do an NFT and just to rake in some cash and don't really give value to the holder, well, then consumers are going to see that, and their reputation is going to be damaged. So this mechanism is a good way for people to invest if they are knowledgeable in that area. Otherwise, not everything is a good investment, but brands can monetize through that strategy and just, incentivize that, create a new fan creator economy.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that you know, I started with the whole ant story is just to put in perspective where we are in this journey, and the fact that we're only going to live for a certain number of years, and the likelihood of these massive blockchain economies, which are going to be the ocean that floats commerce in the future, is likely to just continue many, many generations in the future, to a point where we probably can't envisage what that's going to be like, especially when you see the combination with Internet of Things devices and artificial intelligence transacting on fully automated autonomous exchanges. I mean, it's just going to change the way commerce is done.
I think DAOs are going to be really interesting. You mentioned before, because, you know, DAOs are going to compete with existing corporations. And we know there are advantages of DAOs, and one of them is just being more equitable and opening up an opportunity for people to come together to collaborate. You know, we don't need necessarily a centralized organization, you know, picking the people. Like a community can come together and hire people, coordinate, collaborate, and deliver even more value to the consumer. And I think with this, like, it's not necessarily people in industries should be worried in specific industries, because I feel like we're going through this creative destruction process where the old will need to innovate, and DAOs will play a bigger role. But also with that creation of DAOs comes the opportunity for DAO tooling. So DAOs are going to have to worry about hiring people, paying people, treasury management, governance. These are new sectors, right? There's treasury management protocols, Gnosis and Llama. And then coordinate is a way to pay the DAO members. If you're thinking about community tokens, if you're joining a token gated community in the Discord chat, well, they need to make sure that you hold tokens. Well, how are they going to do that? They don't have time to check everyone's wallet every day. So, you know, Collabland is this bot that pings your wallet and checks if you hold the correct amount of tokens. And so these whole new industries, it's like when the internet came, all these new strategies had to be developed for like marketing and hosting. And I think we're seeing that with DAOs.
Yeah. Wow. So there's a picture I'd like to paint in this, Derek, to your question. Netflix disrupted the blockbusters of the world, right? Used the internet web 2.0 platform to move away from the web 1.0 platform that you could look up the movie, go and pick it up, and Spotify and Apple Music disrupted the BMGs of the world. Mm. So the next wave of that disruption was something like, for example, two examples. One is Audius, you know, Audius, which we talked about earlier on,
yes,
is democratizing the content creation. That doesn't necessarily bring crappy artists to light. It just further accentuates really good artists and some artists who are emerging, and not everybody has to be a superstar kind of model, and gives a chance at an equal footing to all the players to create content and have a sort of a platform for them to, you know, have the content be heard and voted on with the tokens and with the investments that go into it. Second example, again, is, you know, I don't know if you've heard or seen Stoner Cats, which is Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis build this project, which gave you digital rights management to say you need to have a token. So you had to invest in this project to be able to view a content, but that you also are a part owner of the content. So if you don't have the tokens, you couldn't view the content. And you could eventually trade the content or trade the token for something else in future. So imagine a world where I have access to some great content and you have access to different content being in Australia. And we could swap our tokens because we are part owners, and the ownership gives us access to the content, in truly enabling a peer-to-peer, not just a funding model, because you're initializing the funding by investing into that token and benefiting from the success of that content, but also enabling a cohort of yours to be able to borrow your content in return for something else, for viewability or viewing rights to the content. That's Web 3.0 disruption. The content is distributed all over the world. We are enabling a peer-to-peer economy. I think, Jules, to your point, you're spot on and brilliant in that thesis. It's truly going to enable the notion of freedom, and no more you have to stand back of the line for your turn to come. You can just join the platform at equal footing and create your masterpiece.
Yeah, look, that's very, very true. In fact, this brings me to that statement I made earlier on. These are the good old days. These are the days right now, I believe, that history is going to be written about. These are the days when the early emergence of these extraordinary solutions are occurring, and that in 20 years' time, you know, people going, wow, I remember that, you know, that period of time would have been the perfect time to have invested in this or be involved with that or be part of that community. And I feel enormously compelled about this space because of the fact that it can democratize assets. And that a language, you said earlier on, Nitin, when you were in India, doesn't matter where you are, the language that we use relating to blockchain, distributed ledger technology, et cetera, is the same in every country. And so what you're getting is you're getting this diverse global community that's being created, wrapped around the concept of being able to share and democratize assets, ideas, fashion, and people's communication and passion in life. I just can't stop being enthusiastic about it. But one of the great things is when you see the enthusiasm of Jules and how engaged you are with each one of these DAOs that are getting created and the communities that are involved. I noticed that the other day I was listening to how many musical artists write music and upload them per day to Spotify. 20,000 plus songs a day go onto Spotify. And it makes me realize that this globalization that we're talking about with a DAO operating system and or Audius, by example, could also mean that those 20,000 songwriters get an opportunity to play their music for their local suburbs, because they may never make the big time because there's so many of them. But this global macro structure that's getting created here can also enable tremendous local community events occur and local engagement occur, and get back to what I think is the basis of human nature, which is the interaction of barter, a barter of what they know and they're good at, they love, they're passionate about, and they can share that without the interruption of very large rent takers on the way through, the big music companies and the big distributor platforms, et cetera, et cetera. So I am philosophizing, but truly I believe this, and so do I know that the team that we work with and so many of the other podcast presenters that we have on and webinar presenters we have on, see it very clearly too. And so whenever someone comes up to me and says, oh, you could transfer drugs on Bitcoin, I sit there going, oh no, do I need to start with this person and explain that that just doesn't happen to the level they think it does? Or can I actually inspire them about the fact that this future is extraordinary? I hope you take with it that this future is extraordinary. So last words, guys, I welcome your thoughts and maybe a projection forward of where you think this community is going. Over to you.
So just a few thoughts before we come to a close in this piece is that I see that projects like NFTs and decentralized financing is sort of building that new rails and new infrastructure, which allows for that participation, this whole notion of metaverse interaction. And I think we'll see nothing but progress like we have seen with internet. And after almost three decades, we've seen some exponential growth in the global economy. And I think especially in blockchain led innovation, we haven't seen anything yet. So there's a lot more to come. And that excitement, as you rightly mentioned, Derek, is simply contagious. And Jules, you have no idea how much you've inspired in all our calls in the way you think and where you articulate these things, which in some cases makes us think, because we are still thinking from Web 2.0 space, whereas you come natively and think about this differently. So thank you for that inspiration, I would say.
Thanks. I'm glad you guys are embracing it. That makes me really happy that, you know, the wider community, the people who understand the ethos are always in support of it. And it's like, you know, we all love to watch movies where the underdog wins, but you know, I think people don't realize this whole blockchain movement is going for the underdog, you know, the people that haven't been able to be given those opportunities. Like, this is what blockchain is doing. And I think once people really understand the ethos, they will really embrace it.
Very true. Well, that's great. So let bring it to an end. So if you too are also impassioned by this space, as we are, please, you know, like, share our podcast along the way. By all means, write in. If you want to write in to Jules, it's simply jules@portal.am, Nitin@portal.am, Derek@portal.am. It won't always be Portal people on the show, but it is today. And look, I think there's going to be a few speed bumps going forward in the creation of this virtual utopia-like community that we're talking about here. And the number one speed bump is going to be regulations. And so maybe next week, Nitin, we might have a bit of a yarn about where those regulations are up to, what the cultural clash that's occurring that we see coming, what the US is doing, and what that 89-year-old fellow in Alabama that voted against it knows about blockchain technology.
No, absolutely. And we'll try to make it interesting. I think not like all regulatory topics are boring. We'll try to present the global perspective. I personally, in my normal day job, spend a lot of time in this space, in this world, especially in financials. So happy to bring that perspective on the next session, Derek.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Nitin, always for being here. And thank you, Jules, for coming to visit us. And this hopefully won't be the last time you come along to Beyond Bitcoin and visit us along the way.
Yes.
Bye for now.
Bye, guys. Thanks, Jules, for coming over.
Thanks.